Welcome to The Good, The Bad, and The Sequel Q&A. My name's Doug. So next week's sequel, we're going to be diving once again into the beautiful canon films. And luckily, another Charles Bronson Death Wish. This time, Death Wish 4, Crackdown. Ugh. Man, that's going to be an absolute blast. We're bringing back Andrew Powers, our action movie sequel expert, and our Charles Bronson expert as well. And for this week's sequel, we interviewed someone that this was a really early role in their career, and from here, absolutely blew up. He was working so much from this point on, and that is actor Tim Russ. He plays Jesse, who is sort of like a pusher in this movie, and he works for two of the main bad guys. And man, Tim was a blast to talk to. Star Trek people right away, ears perk up. They know him as Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager and a few other of the series that he was in, Generations. Man, Tim was such a blast to talk to because he grew up kind of different. You know, obviously there's a lot of people in the military that grow up this way, kids wise. You know, his dad was in the military, so he moved around a lot. And it was really cool to hear how his first love wasn't even acting. His first love was music, playing guitar. And then he fell in love with acting, went to school in Austin, and then, man, the rest is history. So, of course, we talked about Star Trek, and then we talked about him getting behind the camera on one of the episodes, and also after that. So it was really cool to hear his process, and it was pretty neat that we were going to do an interview, and he was scouting a location, and he went a little bit longer, but for me, I was like, man, that's so cool. So that's the first thing we talk about. I don't know, I might have edited that part out. We were kind of BSing before the actual interview started, but so do me a favor, your first time here, welcome. Please subscribe, like, share, rate us 5 stars. It helps us just get more people to listen to us and enjoy all of our other fantastic interviews. For more stuff like this, you can go to sequelsonly.com and also follow us on all social media at sequelsonly. Without further ado, here is actor Tim Russ.
Hey, what's up? How you doing?
Great. How are you?
Doing all right.
You were scouting a location for something that you're shooting or producing?
Yeah. It was something that I was supposed to be shooting on. It's like a pilot presentation. It's for piece for people. They're pitching this project, so they want to shoot a couple of 3 scenes from it, you know.
Nice.
So it's that kind of thing. Yeah. It was a very nice location. It was great. Didn't get it. I just got out there and got stuck.
Oh, I don't care about that. Don't worry about it, man. So with that end of it, is that something that you wrote or are you just producing?
Oh, no, just directing. Write it, and I'm not producing it, just shooting it.
Nice. And it's so fascinating just that you dabble, I don't want to use the word dabble, but just that you've done so many different facets of the industry. And one cool connection, I talked to Robert Schaefer last year, and we talked Dick Dixter. So there's other things that I want to cover, but I think it's so cool when there's like those little connections from people I interview, because obviously there's millions of movies and TV shows, but how did that project get approached to you? Because you're an executive producer on that?
Yeah, I think he gave me co-producing credit on it and a couple of other people on it as part of the package, but I was just working primarily as an actor on it, talent, and I wrote a couple of songs for the film as well. There's 2 songs that I wrote for it that are in the, he's one opening credit titles, and the other one is inside the movie itself. So I wrote a couple of pieces of music for it and also acted in it, one of the main supporting roles in it.
Yeah, no, he's wild. He loved that role, and he gets into his characters. Now, he was pretty cool to talk to. So to go to the beginning, like growing up, I thought it was so cool, like reading that all the places that you were at throughout your childhood. I think that's so fascinating. Going back, looking back at it now, did you enjoy it back then, or how was it moving so often?
Well, you know, the moving, having to move all the time was not the most fun part of it, because, you know, that was, you're living someplace to make friends and all that, you know.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you got to pack up and move. That was not a lot of fun. You know, I just had to go with it and adapt, you know, to wherever it is we ended up going. And it could be anywhere, you know, for the most part. And in fact, in these many cases, it was just about anywhere, you know. It was something I had to adjust to and get used to, because I pretty much grew up doing that all the time. So,
when did that start? At what age did that start that you guys were moving around?
Oh, it started right at basically right at the beginning.
You know, wow.
I was born in Washington, D.C., and I was only there for 6 or 7 months. It was there. And then I was rocked at Alaska and Nebraska and then overseas to Asia and back to the States, Colorado, and back to overseas the Middle East and back to New York. And then, you know, it was all over the map, man. So it was from the time I was born. We moved there a couple of years.
Looking back, was there like a favorite place? Having the opportunity to do that, like people nowadays, like people that want to be a globetrotter would like, look, just looking at the list, like on your IMDb in the bio that I don't know if you wrote or someone else, it's like fascinating how different, like you said, you go overseas, then like Niagara Falls, overseas, then Omaha. So it's pretty fascinating seeing that.
Yeah. Since I don't have a choice as to where we're going, it's just a roll of the dice as to whether or not you're going to have a good time or not, or whether you enjoy it. And quite frankly, you know, if you're not old enough to enjoy it, you ain't going to be able to enjoy it that much anyway. So the only time it was any fun was when I had, you know, some degree of autonomy, when I was old enough to be able to go out and get in trouble, you know?
Yeah.
So then as long as you got your friends, you know, you can almost get away with just about any place or anywhere. But so it was probably the latter locations that I lived that it was actually the most fun, because I was older, you know. I was a teenager at that time. So we did a lot of things that, you know, because of where I was, we had the opportunity to do that I would not have had the chance to do in the States.
No.
So that was very cool. That was fine, you know, in that regard. But again, it's because I was old enough to, you know, to do whatever it is I was doing. And I had, I think the closest friends and relationships in those latter years, right up to my senior year in high school. I think that's where it became, you know, the sophomore, junior, senior years were probably the best. And the rest of it was forgettable.
Yeah, that was Turkey, right? It says you graduated from high school in Turkey.
Yeah, no, I actually graduated upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
I was in upstate New York when I actually graduated. I was in upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
And it was great. I was playing music and stuff up there. I was enjoying it as well. And so it was cool in that regard. But at the end of the day, I was only there for a year. I mean, literally, I think it was just 1 year, my senior year, and then it was all over.
Wow.
And I was out of there. So
that was Niagara Falls?
No, that was upstate New York. It was in Rome, Utica. So it's not quite as far north.
Oh, okay.
Central New York. Yeah. It was more like central upstate New York. So like Rome, Utica, sort of in the middle of the state. So it was, a little twin town, kind of a dinky town. There's not much going on there. We were on a base in that place. It wasn't, you know, we weren't living in a city or anything. So we were living in a base. And it was okay. It was fine. It was decent enough. I, you know, the connecting tissue was basically music. I was playing in a band at the time.
Nice.
So that's what kept me focused on, you know, on stuff and really enjoying it. I had a couple of friends here and there, you know, I dated a little bit. Outside of that, it was not terribly eventful, because I was only there for, like I said, for a year.
Yeah. So how'd you get into music?
Well, I started music when I was 16. So I've been playing for 45, 46 years somewhere around there. So I've been doing that since I was a young teenager, and I've always enjoyed it, playing guitar and then eventually guitar and vocals. And I'm still playing even today.
I saw that in some of your photos, and I thought that was pretty cool. What was your first passion? Was it playing the music, or was it thinking about doing acting?
Well, the music was first, because I was not exposed to any acting until just before I graduated high school. So before that, I was playing music, started around 15 years old, 15, 16, somewhere in there. I think even 15, I started picking up the guitar. And I played, that was the very first thing, because I was performing in bands, you know, before I left high school, two or three of them. And then the action took over when I went to college and went to go study it. So that's when the acting bug, as it were, took over. And they were both running kind of side by side, you know, for a while after that, until the acting stuff took off, you know. The music is very, very tricky and very difficult. It's different than acting, because there's the music, you have to either make your own music and sell it. You know, you've got to make your own music. You get a record deal, you get it, you know, you sell it, you get something going on there, and you're pushing it and touring and all this stuff. Or, you know, you're just playing in a club band. And if you're playing a club band, you know, that's it. You're not going to, you don't go beyond that point. There's only a certain level you can get to, and that's it. And you either do that forever, or you know, do that and you bail on it, because you can't go beyond, you know, a certain point just doing the top 40 club thing, you know?
Yeah.
You just can't. I mean, weddings and parties and all that shit. You can't, you can only go so far.
Yeah.
In terms of what you're going to make and what you're going to earn doing just that kind of work. And then it's just based on, you know, job to job to job to job. So it's not going to hold that much of a future for you, you know, in terms of making a living from it.
Yeah.
you know, and one could say the same thing about acting, except that once the acting took off, then because of the television work and residuals, you actually are making really good money. And if you get, you know, you book a long-term gig, then you're home free for the most part. So there was a potential in the acting area to actually make some serious money compared to, you know, doing the kind of music that I was doing. I was not pursuing an independent recording career, you know, writing a lot of my own material and trying to get it out there commercially. That's where you make the money, is if you can sell songs that you've written. That's where the money is in that. And I wasn't doing enough of that to warrant making a living out of it. You know, I wasn't going to be, you know, the next whatever on the scene, and that just wasn't going to happen. If it was going to happen, it would have happened when I was in my early 20s, when I first arrived here. If it was going to explode or happen, I would have had something on the ball. I would have had a shot for it, you know, and that doesn't guarantee it, but I would have had a shot.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really even in the game. I was just, you know, walking around and playing live gigs, you know, doing club gigs. So, you know, and that's kept me pretty happy, actually, for a very long time, playing, you know, live gigs. I like that. I enjoy it. There's no pressure, and there's no, you know, I book it when I want to, and I do it when I want to.
That's awesome. How did acting come about when you're at that? Where'd you go to school? Was that in Rome? Where was that where you went to college?
I went to college in St. Edward University, Austin, Texas.
Oh, nice.
It was a theater school down there. It's a very small college, and it had a magnificent theater department at the time I went. And so I did 3.5. I got out of there 3.5 years, so I did 2 summer seasons there. They had summer stock theater. They had the regular shows during the year. They brought in celebrities from L.A. to be in the shows. It was really quite good. Very focused, it was almost like a trade school in a sense. It's a 4-year college, but the way that the program is set up, it's almost like a trade school, because the point was to learn all the aspects about live theater, every area of live theater. You could work in any area of live theater in the 4 years you were there. You could learn it, you could study it, you could actually do it, from everything from playwriting to box office to costumes, lights, sound, directing, acting, everything.
Wow.
And so that when you came out of that 4-year program, the idea was that you could go out and start your own theater. You could go out and open up your own theater. And that was the purpose of that program. And actually, a couple of the students I went to school with did. They actually started their own dinner theater.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Very impressive program at the time. I got ahead of the game being in it, you know, because the program was that good. I got a chance to work professionally before I left. I got to work in a couple of projects that shot there in Austin and got my SAG card as a result. So I was ahead of the game before I arrived in Los Angeles.
What was the first thing you shot in Austin? That wasn't Hunter, was it? Or Crossroads?
No. Okay. The first thing I shot was Masterpiece Theater for PBS. It was a almost a post. Sort of, it took place in the late mid-1800s, just before the Civil War, but about emancipation and some other things. And we shot that down in Austin. I worked with Glenn Turman. And then I did another project there called The Corner, which was a local regional show. It was like a sitcom. A regional sitcom in that area, and I was in that thing for three episodes or one season, and then I moved out to Los Angeles. So it was, you know, those were the first projects. And then once I was here, it took me another 3 or 4 years to get the ball rolling here in LA. And then the first project would have been Fire with Fire with Paramount Pictures. Would have been the biggest project. That's the one that got me started.
What convinced you to go out to LA? It was just something on your mind. Hey, the next step from here is to be there. Okay.
Yeah. You gotta go. You gotta, you know, I spent all that time studying, you know, acting and studying theater and all that. And I said, well, what am I doing if I'm not here, you know, pursuing it? Because you can work, you can find some work in theaters around the country. You can work in regional theater, dinner theater. You can get the ball kind of rolling in that regard. Most of that stuff's going to be musicals because that's what dinner theaters are. They're all musical plays or comedies, things like that. They don't do anything heavy. So you could either do Shakespeare festivals or you could do musical theater, things like that in certain places and areas. And in order to do that, you know, you have to, the issue with that is sometimes they cast those projects actually from LA. They'll cast them from out of town and then the actors will come in and do the show. So if you want to do the bigger lead roles, it's hard to get them because they're not cast actually there, you know. So, you know, but you know, in some cases you could, if I wanted to live in, you know, Oregon or Montana or Kansas or someplace else and just do regional dinner theater, I could, you know, Equity Theater, you know, $400, $500, $700 a week, maybe. I don't know, somewhere in there, possibly. But I wanted to pursue film and television primarily because I knew there was going to be more of a future, you know, if I can strike it in that area. It's going to be more of a future for me financially if I can get into that wheel and go. So I came down and I just moved down here, put everything in my car and just drove down, you know.
What kind of car did you have back then?
Just a hatchback. Okay. Just a little hatchback. Nothing special, just something to get you there.
Yeah, no, that's
at the time, it was good. The car lasted until I wore it out. Yeah. It did the job I was supposed to do.
Fire with Fire. That was, I interviewed D.B. Sweeney a while back and that was like one of his first pictures too.
That's correct. We did Craig Sheffer, D.B. Sweeney, myself, and Virginia Madsen.
Yeah. Look at that.
Yeah, we all worked together on that project. It was fun. You know, we shot it up in Canada. We were up in Vancouver, British Columbia, 7 weeks, I think it was. Came off of that and did Crossroads, and then came off of that and did a couple of commercials and then some TV projects I read for at least, I don't know. I did a few of them at the time, and then the television stuff started taking off. It got really busy.
Yeah, you look at your IMDb, it's like from where you started, like I know you said it took like 2 or 3 years when you got to LA, but from then you're busy. You're working all the time.
Yeah, well, almost everything was shooting here in LA. There was very little outsourced material. Like there was, you know, Stephen Cannell was one of the first to start shooting in Vancouver. That was the very first location where people started shooting out of town. You know, feature films typically could shoot here or they could shoot out of town because sometimes they need the topography and the environment's got to look a certain way. So they're going to have to go to, you know, wherever they go to get those shots in those places. So the films could shoot anywhere. But the television show is basically shot here. So there's a lot of work.
Yeah,
there's a lot of guest star roles, supporting roles, feature roles, whatever it might be, and series regular roles. They're all shooting here, so I was able to book a lot of projects during that time. Plus, you had TV movies of the week, miniseries back in the day. All of the network stuff was there. We didn't have cable and internet and streaming, but we did have three or four networks, and each one of those networks had, a whole slew of shows, and all those shows shot here. Nowadays all those shows shoot someplace else. So yeah. The casting for your principal characters is done out of town, and those roles are not available here. And your supporting roles, especially, a lot of those are shot where they're being filmed. So you don't have the opportunity to work, here in town as much as you did back in the day when I was doing it. So, it takes one half dozen the other. I said we didn't have streaming shows, but a lot of the streaming shows don't shoot here. Most of them don't shoot in town. They shoot out of town. So that's, and that's what it is. It was just, everything just took off and everything was rolling. Once you start working, everybody sees that you're working. They see your credit. So they also see the fact that somebody else invested in you. Somebody else took a chance with you. Somebody else verified that you're a solid actor. So if they know you were on somebody else's show, then why not put them on your show?
That's true.
That's kind of how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, hey, they hired Tim. I'm going to hire Tim.
Yeah, they hired him. Oh, he worked for them. Well, he can work for us. He's verified. The word I want to use is verify. You're verified by somebody else in the professional world hiring you to do the work, and all those parts are all, most of them are just, they're all basically the same. The TV is kind of cookie cutter to start with. All those parts are basically the same. There's not a tremendous amount of difference. Independent film is much different.
Yeah, it sounds like obviously this is something no matter what you had the passion to do, and it proves it. Was there a point, was it getting like Highwayman? Was that a point that you were like, this is it? Because that's a big deal, being pretty much like a regular on the show.
That was a big deal, booking Highwayman. It was the first series that I was able to book as a series regular. So I was absolutely jazzed and thrilled. That was one of my short-term goals, is to get on a series, and that was nice. The first one didn't last for more than 20 minutes, but we were on it. We did a season. And then I did another show called People Next Door, which I did about, I don't know, 5 or 6, 8 episodes of. I don't remember exactly. It didn't last more than a season either. And then we went on to the next one. I did a pilot for something that didn't go anywhere. And then eventually ended up on Voyager. So
that worked out pretty well.
That one worked out okay.
Yeah. So we'll get that in a second. One thing, because it's like one of my favorite movies, like growing up. Again, not saying it's like an Oscar-worthy movie, but growing up, my dad was obsessed with like the Death Wish movies. And Death Wish 4, were you a fan of any of those like Bronson movies or Bronson himself before that came about?
I watched Bronson's earlier work, when I was growing up, when I was in high school and college.
Yeah.
I did watch Charlie and a couple of things. Yeah, I liked his work. I thought he was great. He did some pretty cool stuff. Yeah. I didn't really watch the Death Wish. I think I might have seen the very first one and that was it. I think I watched the very first one and then I didn't see the rest of them. But
then they changed a lot.
Well, yeah, but how many times can you see the same? It's the same note, they just keep remaking them. That's all we do nowadays anyway, just keep remaking stuff.
That's true.
Went over. So instead of just coming up with something different and original, we're just going to keep playing the same note over and over and over. So, and of course, I didn't grow up watching, movies being done over and over and over. There was no, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. It was only one, and then you had another movie that came out later that was different, So I didn't watch all those. I just, when they booked me for that, I just went ahead and did it, played a bad guy and, off and running. And, I got a chance to meet him. He's very nice.
Oh, nice. No, you had some cool lines when you were talking to, I forget her name. She's another big time actress from like the 80s and 90s. The girl that you're, his girlfriend, I guess.
Somebody. Yeah. I don't actually remember all of it. I know he ends up killing me at some point in time. I don't remember how many scenes I had. I know we were shooting down at the pier, Santa Monica Pier, and that's quite a busy place to be rolling in. They managed to get that whole thing secured and locked off.
Oh, wow.
Must have cost them a fortune. But that's where That's where we shot it. It was down at Santa Monica Pier, at least some of it anyway. I don't actually remember the other stuff.
Yeah, that's where most of your scene. Her name is Kay Lenz. She's in like a bunch of stuff, like the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But yeah, that movie is insane. It's done by Canon Films. So like in the 80s, Canon was like where Charles Bronson worked.
That's where a lot of people work. Yeah, everybody worked for Canon. Canon was making 25 films a year.
Yes, they were.
They were making more films than the major studios were. Yeah. Oh yeah. They were like an assembly line. I mean, it was Canon pick, man. They made literally 25 movies a year. They were filming all the time.
Yep.
You know, those two guys, they got in trouble and got busted for something eventually, but they were definitely, it was a warehouse. It was a factory of films, Canon Pictures. I think that was the only one I worked for them for was Death Wish 4.
You know? Yeah, most of their movies are pretty bad, but they would have
most
like
of them are. Yeah.
every so often, like Runaway Train with Eric Roberts.
Every once in a while. They had some pretty cool stuff in there. Yeah. Runaway Train was great.
Yeah.
That was a really good movie. It was actually quite good. That was one of the only ones I saw that they did. I might have seen one other one, but I don't remember.
Yeah, that was one of Danny Trejo's first movies, and then he's in Death Wish 4 as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Danny Trejo, that's correct. That's correct, yeah, yeah. That's cool.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
So then, again, you have so many credits on here, but like Star Trek. So growing up, were you a fan of it before this opportunity came up? Because it says here that you did it. You did audition for the series in 87.
I auditioned for the first reboot, the original reboot of the series. Yeah. Because when they brought it back, they called me in to read for one of the lead roles for that one. And then the next one after that. And then I just kept reading for the show. I watched it, you know, on occasion growing up because we only had three channels back then. Yeah. They played the show constantly, and they played, you know, other stuff constantly as well. And I know as much about that as I do Gilligan's Island. I can tell you all those episodes too, because they were always on.
Yeah.
So I was familiar with the show. Absolutely. Cause you can't, it was inescapable, you know, and some of the stories are iconic, and some of the, you know, storylines in the episodes are iconic. The whole show is iconic. It's a very popular show all over the world. But I wasn't going to conventions or collecting anything and all that stuff. I just watched the show, you know, when it was on. I would catch it here and there. And over time, I ended up seeing, you know, like I said, Twilight Zone, you know, I Love Lucy, what is it, Mayberry, Andrew Mayberry. I mean, all those shows ran 100% of the time. And we watched all of them because that's what was on. We didn't have VHS. We didn't have DVD. We didn't have streaming. We didn't have binge watching. We didn't have cable. We didn't have HBO. None of that stuff existed when I was in college. So we had three networks. That's it. Maybe the little independent network is the fourth one, but it's basically three networks. So, you know, syndication was just, you know, it was just repeat alley for years and years and years until cable came waltzing in, and then they started playing repeats when they first came on. They would just play stuff that's already been on, you know, old TV shows and old movies. That's what they did. And then from there, they started doing their own programming. But keep in mind, I mean, all the things we did not have to watch, that's what we had to watch.
Yeah. It's cool that you said you watched Twilight Zone, and then you were able to be on that reboot in the 80s, which is pretty neat.
Yeah, just a minute. I didn't have much to do on that episode, but I was on it for a second. Sure, yeah. It was kind of a, you know, it was a thrill from a nostalgic standpoint to be able to work on that show. So it was great. Yeah, it was cool. I'll do it. I'll take it.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Especially something like that. You grow up watching it. So with Star Trek, when you did the reading in 94, 95, so was that like a long process, like landing that role?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a long process. Yeah. You had to keep going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. You know, it took, you know, they did three series. They got two series before they got to Voyager. Voyager was the third one.
Yeah.
And I read for all of those shows, you know, and then I booked a couple of them and then one of the features and then eventually Voyager. So 7 years. It was a 7 year sort of process, you know, not being able to see what was coming, obviously. But the show, but every time I turned around, I was going in to read for something. You know, they liked me. They just didn't have a spot for me until Voyager came. And then it was, the stars lined up. And the stars have to line up, otherwise it doesn't happen. You know?
Yeah, that's a game changer. Like, now you're talking about, like, when you started, get on a series, that was your goal. And I think you got on the right one for as many episodes that was on.
Yeah, you want to stay, you want to get on a show that stays on the air. That's the main thing. So get on a show, first goal. Second goal, get on a show that stays on the air. That's the second goal. And ultimately, being able to book, you know, that particular series, that was precarious because I could have been, you know, I don't know, I could have been off shooting an episode or a movie somewhere and I'd have missed the whole damn thing. I don't know if they would have waited, you know, for me to be off that project to have me come in and read for Voyager. I don't know if they would have held up production on that series, you know, waiting for me to have a chance to read for it. If I was busy booked in another thing for a month or two, or I don't know, something else, I could have been, I could have missed that window, man.
You're right. The stars have to align.
Very lucky to be available. Yeah. Yeah. At the time, I made it a point at the time to not be booked, you know, when I knew they were going to be casting for that thing. So I did make an effort. I did make a proactive effort to not be out of town, you know, to not be tied up for 2 months.
So one thing I did that was pretty cool today, I watched the episode that you directed. So how did that come about? That did you ask them, hey, I would like to direct an episode, or did they come to you?
No, I went to them and I asked if I could have an opportunity to do so. And myself and other castmates, that show and the show before me, the show before ours, they all did the same thing. We have a chance to intern while the series is running. So you intern for 2 to 3 seasons. I think it was 2.5 seasons. The third season, the third year of the internship was when they gave me the episode to direct. So you're basically... you're hanging out in the editing room a lot. You're in pre-production meetings. You are in post-production meetings. You're in editing sessions with the producers. You are in, you know, all this stuff that you're close to and you're getting a chance to get experience from. You can shadow directors who are working on set and follow them, figure out what's going on, watch what's happening, observe how they do their coverage and all that good stuff. And the best thing was to sit with the editor and watch him piece everything together, and knowing what that footage was before it became a scene is important. So that's how it happened. And then they gave me a slot, and I loved that episode. I was lucky to get that one. I could have drawn a turkey. I can tell you that right now. So I could have drawn a dog.
Yeah. I can tell you watching that, it almost gives you chills about like the parallels about like what's going on. It's just the way they take, you know, the characters in that show and the different species and the way they, it was crazy watching that, how like it hit like so now about what's going on in today's society. And it's a great episode.
Yeah, it actually is very important. It's very important to see. I mean, hell, it's unfolding as we can watch right now in the Middle East, with Israel and Palestine. You were looking at something that directly parallels that episode, because you have two groups of people who are living side by side, but, you know, one group may feel as though they are, you know, not treated equally or fairly, and one that feels that there's nothing, you know, that's not the issue. And so you have, in the episode, you have, based on history, based on an historical event that was misinterpreted, it causes the cultures to come down to how each group and each culture in that civilization is being looked at or treated and what their status is in the society. It's all based on what they thought had happened. And given that, you know, if you look at our history, anybody's history, I mean, the things weren't recorded the same way that they're recorded today. So, you know, the interpretation of what events occurred back in the past were written down by the people who were victorious. It was written by the people who won, who were the victors. So their interpretation is what you end up getting. And that's kind of what that episode is about. You're getting it from one side, not the other side. You're not getting the facts. You're getting something else. And you're right. You know, what is the truth? And that's what we're dealing with in our country right now. What is it? What actually happened?
Yeah.
And what's bizarre about then, you know, in that episode, you know, it was recorded. There was a recording of it. So you could actually see what actually happened. In our society today, we actually live through and experience with our own eyes and ears things that happen. But a segment of our society chooses to not believe it, chooses to not see it, to dismiss it or to pretend it never happened. That's very bizarre.
No.
And from an historical standpoint, and this will be, you know, a moment in history, this will be looked back upon. It will be studied. It will be looked back upon. It will be criticized. It will be, you know, examined forever. And, you know, I'll be fascinated to learn how this time is interpreted, how it is looked at, you know, 20, 30 years from now, when we look back, or 40 years from now.
Yeah.
And say, oh, yeah, that was the period in which, you know, part of the society, a large segment of society, believed in just the craziest stuff on the planet, refused to acknowledge what the facts and what real facts and information and truth what is. I mean, that's just mind-boggling to me. And that's what that episode, you know, kind of dealt with, is that the truth and the facts were completely muddled, and it caused such an upheaval in that society, a lot of tension in the society. But when the truth was revealed, it causes major chaos because, of course, everybody's really pissed off at what happened. It would be the same as if you had slavery that happened, you know, 300 or 400 years ago, and then come to find out there was never any slavery, that slavery never happened. You know, then the whole you know thing switches back and forth. I mean, that's what it would be like, just as an example. You know, if that was the case, like slavery never occurred. Oh, really? Well, how would that change the dynamic of a society if you had that occur? And that's what that episode was kind of all about.
And I think that's what's great about Star Trek, that they're able to, within those episodes, they can have, not maybe as deep as that one, but they can talk about those other things within it. And
yeah,
it's pretty fascinating that they're able to do that. Like the writing of that show is so fascinating.
Oh, the writing on the show is amazing. It has always been good. It's about telling stories. Trek, you know, the Trek world, the Trek, you know, thing is about stories, and it always has been. And to the exclusion of trying to keep up with, you know, the lore and the stories from, you know, 100 episodes ago, or this alien did that and they can't do this because they're just that way. And they, you know, forego with the details like that in exchange for telling a good story. It's all about a story. And it's much deeper than, for example, people compare it to Star Wars. Star Wars is a very different model. It doesn't have the same, not the same model, it's not the same type of storytelling. Whereas Trek is about people, it's about the characters, the interaction of the characters, the decisions the characters make, and the dilemmas the characters face, and how they deal with it, how they act. And it's also a mirror, typically a mirror of our own society. In many respects, the things that are happening in our society, the turmoil and the conflicts are played out with aliens and humans. And that's what they do. That's what makes that show really, really successful. Is definitely the writing. My hat's off to them, because you got to respect the writers, man. It's all about the writing. That's what it comes down.
So when did you obviously you knew the show, that, you know, the two iterations before were so popular, but when did you know that it was to the point that things must have changed for you right away, right? Like people recognize you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're going to get people who notice
who you are. They recognize who you are. That does happen, and it still happens even today.
I bet.
The fans of the show are very, very enthusiastic and dedicated and loyal. And they can spot you a mile away. the nature of the business, you know. It's fine. It doesn't bother me. I'm used to it by now. I typically, you know, one of the things I typically don't do that much of I try not to anyway, is do too many. I don't do that many interviews that are only focused on, you know, Star Trek. And
stuff,
only because I've talked about this stuff infinitum. And it's just the same thing over and over again. So, you know, as far as that goes, I kind of sort of steer into other things that are more interesting. But, you know, the recognition factor, that changes. All that changed. And how people see you and how people treat you is different because of it. And I was kind of aware of that before going into it, although it really isn't the same until you actually experience it. You know, intellectually, you can think about it, but until it actually happens, you know, physically, you don't realize just, you know, what that means. And I'm just a small player, man, compared to, you know, the super mega stars who couldn't go 20 feet without, you know, 1400 paparazzi or somebody screaming and hollering. So I don't have to worry about that. I have no paparazzi outside my doors.
That's good. No TMZ knocking on Tim's door. But I thought it was pretty cool that there's an action figure of you. That's really neat.
Yeah, it's an action figure. Yeah, it's kind of weird when it first came out. It's kind of weird, kind of bizarre. except for the fact that it's not you, it's the character.
Yeah.
Now, if it was an action figure of just me, you know, as the person, that would be freakish. But since it was the character and it's in costume and all that hazarata, okay, well, fine. It takes the onus off of it being so bizarre, you know. I mean, it was interesting because I didn't expect it. I didn't think about it until all that stuff came out. You know, I know we got merch to deal with, but I didn't realize how much they were going to do and to what extent it was going to be. And I'd forgotten about all that. And all of a sudden it came out. And I thought, and then we all looked at these boxes with our dolls in them and said, holy crap, there's a doll, you know? And so for a moment it did hit you that it was kind of weird. And then after that it was, what the hell? It's merch, you know, it's the franchise. That's how they make their extra money, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of it. So when it comes to the directing end of it from that episode, was that something afterwards you were like, man, I got to direct more or write more? Cause then you started writing right after that.
Yeah.
You're probably always writing, right?
Yeah, some writing. I don't consider myself a writer. I've co-written some things with people and I've revised some scripts here and there. I don't consider myself from scratch a writer because I'd rather let somebody who really knows how to do that well do it.
Yeah.
I also don't like producing that much because I hate the paperwork, but I do like shooting. I like directing.
Yeah.
So I would prefer to work with the writer on the story, on the concept, on the story. I might do some revising of the script myself here and there, but mostly I work with the writer producers or writer and producer, and come up with the concepts, come up with the ideas, and then flesh them out and get them done on paper, and then try to, you know, get them done. I enjoy shooting stuff and directing stuff because of the challenge. Now, granted, you know, as soon as you know, after 3 days on the set, you haven't slept, you know, in 24 hours because you're exhausted. Then I ask myself, what the hell am I doing this for? but it is exhausting work. It's a lot of mental gymnastics and very, very long days. And when you come home at night, you're still thinking about what you got to do the next day. You're still putting stuff together and it's like a puzzle piece because you might, you know, I don't always work off a storyboard. So it's not like just going there and following a bunch of pictures. I might want to change this or do that, or the actor may want to try this or try that, or the location might change and we have to do something different because we have a different location. So it's depending upon what kind of project it is, you know, it's a lot of mental gymnastics and trying to play with this picture puzzle, you know, front and back, and you don't want to forget anything. You don't want to miss anything. So there's the stress of not screwing up, because once you're in the editing room, you're going, oh Christ, I could have, you know, I didn't get this, or I didn't get that, or I should have shot that, or I should have shot this. And you don't want to be in that situation. So it's really a hell of a lot of work. I mean, as an actor, you just come on and do your scenes and go let your trailer and relax. You don't have to think about anything else. But as a, you know, the director's on there for every single scene, every single shot, every single minute. And that will wear your ass out, man. You know, so yeah, it's a hell of a process. I like the creative, you know, getting it together and designing it and getting it lined up and doing it. But when you're actually doing the nuts and bolts of shooting, man, it catches up to you after about 2 or 3 days, man. I am exhausted.
Do you ever forget like that you're like, oh man, there's so much to it. And then like 2 to 3 days, it's like a new project or a new film.
Oh,
that
yes,
you're shooting. And you're like, oh no, this, I forgot about it.
Yeah, oh yeah, I forgot about it. I forgot what that was like. Yeah, of course. Absolutely. That happens. That does happen. You come out of it and then you think, oh my God, I'm going to take a break. I don't want to do that for a while. And then you come back and all of a sudden you're right back in the middle of the next thing. Sure. Absolutely. That happens. It is quite the experience to work, you know, in that capacity on a project like that, and to work, you know, putting together a story and then being able to watch that story, you know, come to life, you know, in the editing room, you know, when it's cut together. So it's fascinating to be able to see that process from the page to the picture, you know. It's pretty cool. I enjoy it.
Is it hard doing the double duty of directing and acting in something?
Yeah, I don't particularly care to do that.
Yeah.
I don't understand how anybody, I don't understand anybody does that. I just don't, I can't do that, because I've only done it a couple of times for just a couple of walk-ons and cameos for some projects, because the producer wanted me to be in it or something. But and every time that happened, man, it was nothing but distracting. It's distracting for me. I can't focus on it, and it becomes an afterthought instead of, you know, a major focus. It's splitting your attention and your energy in doing it. So I don't like doing it, you know. And if it's something I had to do, or, you know, something that they just begged me to do or something, I'll step in for a minute. But I'm not going to do a major arc of a character in front while I'm shooting it as well, if I can avoid it. It's not for me, you know. I'd rather do one or the other.
No, I forgot who I talked to, and they did that one time because somebody convinced them and they thought they could do it. And they were like, it was so hard to, like, you're basically impossible. Trying to give yourself notes.
Yeah, it's impossible. It's impossible. I mean, it's not impossible, and people do it all the time, but, you know, you're basically your DP, your director of photography, has to take over. You have to have somebody who you can rely on to get the shots done properly and get them lit right, whatever, right? And you're in two different places looking at the screen from behind the camera, and then you go in front of the camera, and you go behind the camera, and you go in front of the camera. I mean, people do it. What's his name? I worked with George Clooney recently. He was directing Midnight Sky, and you know, he was in front of the camera. You go behind the camera, watch the scenes through, go back in front of the camera. You know, I mean, that can also take, you know, twice, two times, three times longer, because
that
you have to
sure.
go back and watch the scene. And now you're taking up longer than it would take normally to get your 12 setups or whatever it is, scenes a day done. So it's not always, to me, it's not always the best thing. I like I said, I would rather be in one place or the other, you know. And I said, you know, then to try to do it all at the same time. And there's plenty of other actors out there who can get in front of the camera. Doesn't have to be me. Plenty of other people.
So obviously acting is like what you started doing. Is there one that, do you enjoy one more than the other?
Yeah, well, it's the one is, the scope is different. The challenge and the scope is different. One is, they are two different things. The acting is only part of the canvas. You're just one color. Part of the canvas, and directing is the whole canvas. You're responsible for all the colors, all the parts. So, you know, one is a greater challenge creatively, and the other one is just, you know, you're coming on and you're playing a role, and you're trying to achieve the best level of honesty and believability in that role. And if you can, to move people emotionally in some way, shape, or form. And if you can do that, you know, that's the challenge of the acting, but the acting is on a scale that's just you. It's not the whole project. So there's two different things. And if it's just if it's about being at the helm of the project behind camera for directing, I would choose that first over acting in a role because of the challenge. So it gives you something to shoot for. Whereas a role, I've been doing that for 38 years. So
yeah.
It's not like I can't figure out what I'm doing as far as, you know, acting roles. You can do different types of parts and you can do some roles you've never done before, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, there's always that possibility, but it's acting. It's been on stage or in front of camera. So as opposed to the stuff behind camera, well, that can be just about anything. And you can have just, you know, you can go anywhere you want. You can try this, try that, you know, do something that hasn't been done, do something you really liked in another project and rip it off and do it yourself because it was that cool. You can try something, you know, I mean, the tapestry is all yours if you're behind the camera. It's the whole thing is yours. And you're telling a story. You're telling a story that's just, it's complete, like it's linear, it's complete, it's a through all the way, a through line all the way through it, and to make it climax and come to the place where it's supposed to come, that's a hell of a challenge all the way around. It's really a big challenge.
Yeah, like the payoff's got to be worth it when you talk about like scout, when you're scouting a location and you do the shot and you're doing the editing and you see how it comes out, it's got to be something special and it works out. Yeah. It's got to be such a thrill because you don't get to see that most of the, you know, probably all the time as an actor. You don't see it until it's on TV for the most part, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You don't have anything to do with that once it's done. I mean, if you're acting, and unless you're the producer of the project, you know, yeah, you won't see diddly squat, you know, until it's actually cut together. And good luck, you know. You hope they left your scenes in, you know, because there are times when they don't leave your scenes in. So, yeah, when you act on it, you can only, you know, ask the director, are they happy? Did they get what they want? Is everybody cool? And then you move on to the next thing. And that's it. And you have to forget about it after that because, like I said, you can end up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah.
It's happened to me a couple of times just in the last year. Yeah. And that's the way that goes, man. That's the way that goes. That's showbiz, as they say.
This guy I work with is actor Larry Henkin. He went to a premiere. He was in Pretty Woman. And Gary Marshall, who he knew from like another few projects he worked with him, Gary Marshall never told about the premiere that they cut a scene. So in the one scene when he plays Julia Roberts' landlord, you only see like the back of his head. And he like brought a date. He brought a date and they were like sitting there and he's like, oh, where's my part?
That is really interesting. I guess there's a scene from the movie that I actually really like a lot. And I've seen this thing 3 or 4 times and it always catches me off guard. And I always wonder if I ever went into him, I'm going to ask him because I'm sure he remembers this. But it was Shyamalan in the movie. It was a lady in the water. And there's a shot where this major character comes up to the lead character in it. You never see her face. And there's a whole conversation with the lead character. He's asking a couple things and she's responding or whatever. So he never cuts to her coverage.
Wow.
He never cuts to her face. He never does. And I always wondered why he did it like that. Because the rest of the movie got coverage, but there was no coverage in that moment. It's the only time in that movie where there's no coverage. And it's the first time that character is on the screen. It's not like you saw them before that. It's the first time that you see them. I'm almost positive it's the first time you see her. And it's only on her back.
It's weird.
You never see her face. And it's fascinating. I always wondered why. I wondered if maybe, you know, there was a mistake or there was something wrong with the coverage or the footage or something happened and it couldn't use the coverage because that character is very colorful, literally very colorful and very animated and interesting. all the characters are in there. And sure enough, if you ever watch it, it's called Lady in the Water. It's one of his movies. Interesting piece. Very interesting piece. Very different.
That's great that you caught that. That was your director eye.
Yeah, it was. And I do catch stuff like that all the time. And change screen directions are wrong, or something's not continuity's off, or something else. You know, or I'll look at a film and how it's covered. And sometimes I've seen something where there's very, very little coverage at all. And it's interesting how those movies play. When you watch the scene without coverage, then your eye has to do the editing. Your eyes and ears do all the editing. You look at who you want to look at. And the camera's not telling you where to look. And that's the difference between, you know, when you're telling the audience where to look. And telling them, you know, who's going to react and who isn't. Whereas when you have the two people on camera at the same time, there's no cut. Then it becomes about not only the timing of the actor's dialogue, because when you cut, you can control the timing. You can control the pace. So that scene, if it's a three shot or two shot and there's no cut, the pace of that scene, there's no making it longer or shorter. It is what it's going to be.
Fascinating. Tim, so one quick, thanks for taking the time. One question I always like to ask people, when you were like early on in your career, did you ever keep any mementos from set, like any scripts or anything for down the road, like to look back on?
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of scripts from projects that I worked on, series projects, that just two. I mean, I have one or two from Trek, and I have one or two from Samantha, who I worked on. I think I still have one of their scripts.
No highwayman, or
I don't think I have a highwayman script, nor do I have any memorabilia from there. No, don't have any of that stuff at home. I just have the scripts from those two shows. Just one script, I think. Or maybe two or three of the Trek scripts. They're signed and all that. So
nice.
They're more like collector's items. But that's all I have. I typically don't keep the parts and pieces of those shows.
That's cool. Yeah, that's where my wife knew you from. She was like, Samantha who? He's on Samantha who? I'm like, yep, he is.
Oh, yeah. It was a wonderful show. That thing was amazing. I mean, Melissa McCarthy, she's, you know, she exploded after that series, and she was that good, you know, at doing what she did. And she was on that, and it was one of the regulars. Gene Smart. I mean, come on, man. Christine Applegate. You got guns on that show.
And yep.
It was also written really, really, really well. It was written, you know, with the humor sort of intertwined in the dialogue. It wasn't, you know, we're trying to reach for the jokes. You know, the jokes were in the lines. The humor was in the lines. And some of it was circumstantial and was just the way that the actors played it. It was very subtle. It was understated. It wasn't over the top. It was a really good show. It was unfortunately, what you run into these days is that the network is butting heads with the producers and writers, and so you got issues with that sometimes. I think that's what happened on that show. We had a writer's strike as well, right in the middle of it. So yeah, that's probably what killed it. So because we were winning our time slot every night.
It's terrible when that happens with shows.
Yeah, she got awards and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible, you know. You don't have any control over any of that, you know. Some suit and tie in a, you know, high-back chair with a, you know, cell phone is making a decision rather than, you know, the people who are writing and producing.
Yeah.
That's what you get, man. That's what you get.
Well, thanks, Tim. It was fun talking, directing, and have a good rest of your night. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, bud. Take care.
Tim was a blast. I loved his reaction when I asked him about being an action figure, because I haven't talked to a lot of people that were action figures, like actually themselves. Obviously, he talked about it wasn't really a Tim Russ action figure. It was for Tubik, but it looks like him. You could say that's him, which it is. But it was cool to talk about his transition and his love behind the camera. Even though it's such a painstaking, involved process, he just loves it so much that he's just going to keep doing it. So, your homework?
Death Wish 4. It's on Amazon Prime for free. I'm sure some other places you could find it. Andrew, our action movie sequel expert, will be back. I don't know what he's going to have in store because we're recording that review actually right after I get done with this. So don't forget to review, rate, share our podcast. Follow us on all social media at Sequels Only. And don't forget to check out our website, sequelsonly.com. Good night.